this very day in 1966, John Lennon's statement that the Beatles were more popular than Jesus Christ was published in the London Evening Standard. His opinions drew no controversy when published in the UK, but gosh, they blew up in the US a few months later. Angry reactions flared up, particularly in Christian communities. Extensive protests broke out, with some stations banning Beatles songs, and the records were publicly burned. The controversy coincided with the band's 1966 US tour and overshadowed press coverage of their newest album, Revolver. Lennon later apologised at a series of press conferences and explained that he was not comparing himself to Jesus Christ. But here is the... I've never read the whole quote, and here it is, for what it's worth. Christianity will go, it will vanish and shrink. I needn't argue about that. I'm right and I'll be proved right. We're more popular than Jesus now. I don't know which will go first, rock and roll or Christianity. Jesus was all right, but his disciples were thick and ordinary. And it's them... It's them twisting it that ruins it for me. So it's quite a strong quote. You are both MPs. So if you said something like that, it would follow you around for years.
Yeah, well, my hero, John Lennon, I do recall him actually being forced to apologise. And
right.
I do recall that it haunted him for, you know,
yes.
all of his life. Yeah. But yeah, to some extent, he's correct, of course, about... religion declining, it certainly is.
That was his point, apparently. He wasn't trying to make any sweeping gesture, but just that at the moment we are quite popular. Now, I was living in London in the 80s and working in a wine bar in South Kensington. Imran Khan, the Pakistani cricket captain at the time, came in and I served him. He asked me out on a date and I went out with him for a few times.
Mm.
He was the perfect gentleman, but I was slightly overwhelmed, so it never went any... further, and your feedback is still coming through about ridges up or ridges down. We might keep that for the Friday mailbag. 27 to 5, the panel, RNZ National. Wellington's Mayor Andy Foster has backed down on a controversial idea to sell part of the city's earthquake-prone library to help pay for the cost of upgrading it. The idea was to sell 40% of the library, and it caused... an outcry. But Mr. Foster backtracked today during a meeting to discuss the council's long-term plan following a change of heart from some councillors. Not before his leadership or lack of was criticised in the media. This, of course, all comes on the back of other woes for the capital, including broken and leaking pipes, a lack of movement on transport fixes. And we thought we've got two Wellingtonians with us, but for another one of the mix, we thought we'd get Dave Armstrong, who is a regular commentator on all things Wellington. Dave, kia ora.
Kia ora, Wallace, how are you?
Great to have you on, Dave. Look, what's your take on this? What do you make of the latest to come out of today's meeting?
Well, I mean, what I can tell, I mean, I haven't been at the meeting.
No.
Everyone's been on good behaviour. Everyone's been nice to each other. It's play nice day in Wellington, from what I can tell, because there have been... a lot of recriminations and things like that. Then it became obvious councillors Laura Foon, Sarah Free and Nicola Young considering some people sort of went, oh well, you were wrong, you should never have been doing such terrible things. You know, one must bear and they might put on them, and we should be a little bit irritable and say, well, people are allowed to fly kites and people are allowed to actually argue these things and come back. It would be an awful situation if no one could change their vote. So I welcome the vote to keep it in public control. But I also think we should thank the people that have changed, because despite all the talk last week, Andy actually got 11 of his remits through, you know. So this is democracy in action, I suppose.
It's democracy in action. And it's your own opinion. So far, on a scale of 10 being fantastic and 1 being terrible, how do you think the Mayor Andy Foster's doing as a mayor?
Well, I think that's a sort of unfair question for this. I'll have a few caveats. One is that he's liked by people even who disagree with his politics. Andy is a tremendously nice guy. I've known him a while. I like him. He's honest. He's trying his best. However, he hasn't always been good at doing the numbers. And there are those that say he hasn't kept people in control. He reminds me of myself when I was a school teacher. Mr. Armstrong, you're being too nice and you're not dealing with the naughty kids. So I'll go down the middle and say five. Could do better.
Okay.
But I have noticed that you know, he has tried. Look, he's tried to get a consensus going, and it hasn't always been good, and it hasn't worked. The hard thing is he doesn't really have a majority who are confident in him. And if you look at the Don Post Saturday article, it became obvious that a slight majority don't confident.
Dave, stay with us. We have two guests in the Wellington studio there. And Sue Kedgley, you first, perhaps, because you have worked in the council arena. In fact, I think you've worked with Andy Foster, haven't you, for some years? Or used to?
Well, yes, I came across this photo the other day, 1992, of Wellington City councillors. And there was myself and Andy Foster.
Right.
So he's been a councillor for 28 years, you know, more than a quarter of a century. Look, I agree he's extremely, very nice guy, as Dave said, perfectly capable, middle-of-the-road councillor, voted in year after year. But he should never have been mayor. He's completely out of his depth because he lacks the political skills to be a leader, in my view. He's still acting like a councillor. And oddly enough, he would never have been the mayor were it not for Peter Jackson, because Andy stood twice to be mayor, got a couple of thousand votes, and it was only last time when Peter Jackson came flying in with, I can't remember, was it 60,000 or something? We had these massive billboards all over Wellington. He sneaked in by a few votes and became the mayor. But Andy, he's a details man. He's not the big picture. He's a loner, not a leader. And he doesn't seem to have those skills that you need as mayor to build a consensus. I mean, fancy, or even to have the political nous to know that selling the public library as a sort of, or part of it, of the building, at the 11th hour, was going to fall flat on its face.
Pretty
political instincts there.
Yeah, interesting. Pretty strong words.
But
great as a councillor, completely inept as the mayor. Your words, who cares? Extraordinary. Chris Finlayson.
Well, it's despairing, really. John Key got into trouble when he said Wellington was a dying city, but exhibit one of the fact that we are an advanced state of putrefaction is our crummy council. And frankly, these guys are simply not up to it. And it's quite despairing to see the quality of people on the council. Nicola Young's good, there are a couple of others who are good, but the rest of them are not up to it. I go back to what Sir John Jeffries, a former High Court judge who was Deputy Mayor of Wellington, told me. He was the Labour man. Dennis McGrath was the National person. They went down to the council at 5 o'clock in the evening. Probably Dennis Foote was another one, made a few decisions about the running of council and then got on with their lives. The problem is that many of these councillors are full-time. We don't need full-time councillors. We need people who are skilled in governance, and whether they're of the left or of the right. But what we have is a group of minnows who don't know how to run a city, and it's a tragedy.
Goodness, a group of minnows who don't know how to run a city, and it's a tragedy. Dave Armstrong, your thoughts, feedback.
Well, you get the politicians you deserve. Well, you know, we can bring in a military regime if we like, but I believe in democracy. What worries me about democracy is that the thing about democracy is 40% of Wellingtonians vote, and that's not enough. And we've got to get ways of getting to vote. And so, you know, I don't agree with a lot of the decisions the council makes, but you've got to make it better and you've got to contribute. There are some good things happening, and it's not all a disaster. And the other, I think the review is badly chosen, and I think that probably just the improvement in behaviour with all the publicity that's gone on to the council will be a good thing. But I think to always constantly complain about politicians and do anything yourself or not get involved, I think is the problem.
Sue?
I agree with that. And also the other thing is Wellingtonians are incredibly divided about many of the issues.
Right.
Half of the people want, let's get Wellington moving in a second Mount Vic tunnel and whatever. The other half don't want it. Some want a new library. Some want to refurbish the existing one. And councillors, to a certain extent, are reflecting fixing the divisions in the community. And also in a cabinet, it's all done behind closed doors. In this council, as a council, you're sort of yoked together with these 14 people, and all of your business is in public and under public scrutiny. But I think probably the Wellingtonians have been rather repelled by all the bickering, and hopefully it will give councillors a bit of a wake-up call. But I think Andy has to stop presenting 11 fundamental last-minute amendments, and which he's never even, talked through. He should have talked it through. He should have got consensus in working groups. He should act like a mayor.
Okay.
And Anita Baker in Porirua says she gets all her councillors in her office every single week. She has them home. She works very, very hard to get the councillors to get on and have a consensus. And I think that's what we need in Wellington.
Well, what we need is to move away from intergenerational negligence and focus on a few basic issues like fixing up pipes and why we have a water pipe for Wellington which sits on the Wellington Fault coming down from Kaitoke amazes me. There are plenty of what could be called the non-sexy issues that the councillors should be united on and should get things done on, but they're simply incompetent and incapable of doing so.
From the outside looking in, Dave, I mean, just looking at it wider, and maybe as a jumping-off point, that quote from John Key, that Wellington's a dying city, what was he seeing there? Was he just ahead of his time or when he said
we're
that?
We're not a dying city. We're doing brilliantly.
Dave? This is ridiculous, this comment about dying. If you go through Wellington, yes, there's pipes are a problem. It is not a dying city. It is culturally fantastic. It is full of lots of neat things happening. There are cafes that are great. If you live in Wellington, you have a good time. You get driven crazy by the incompetent Patton model that Chris and his colleagues brought in with public transport. Yes, that's true. You get mad with the 100-year neglect that you've had of the water pipes. Yes, that's true. You know, there are things you think you're walking past the bucket fountain, but it's actually a pipe leaking. But what's amazing is it's still just a fantastic city. It's
completely.
A great place to be.
Oh, you're just mouthing the usual inanities about the coolest little capital.
No.
This city has been underperforming. This city has been underperforming for a number of generations, and it is going down the drain.
Yes, we need to fix our pipes, and Wellington is fabulous and never been better.
And walk around Oriental Bay today and you do not see or Cuba Mall or Upper Cuba Street or Lambton Quay or Tawa, and you have a great time. Yes, there are definitely problems. But you see, the thing is to call it dying and to call it moribund.
Ridiculous.
Okay. Oh, blah, blah, blah. It's all clichés.
Well, Chris,
when
Millicent, are you...
clichés, Chris.
Chris, it's a dying city.
The great leader, John Key, said it was dying.
Well, he was right.
Boring,
absolutely correct.
I mean, what about Auckland? Every city in New Zealand has problems of
you're one of the guilty people. You're on the council for 15 years, weren't you?
8 years.
Oh, whatever.
In the 90s.
Chris, can I ask you...
Yeah.
He was in government. What did you do about fixing the leaking pipes in the 8 years that you were Attorney General, Chris?
Not a lot. Slightly outside my remit.
Oh, no, you were in the cabinet. Joint responsibility.
Chris didn't talk Wellington out of its misery.
Chris, where do I go from here? Chris, can I ask you this?
Sure.
Are you proud of your city? Are you proud of being a Wellingtonian?
Oh, I love Wellington. Nothing fills me with greater joy than to march up Mount Kaukau and look down on this beautiful city, which is the apotheosis of mismanagement and stupidity. And mistakes have been made, they keep on being made, and we have city leaders who are not up to the job.
And do you include some of the Conservative leaders we've had for many decades there?
Well, I talk about we've had some wonderful people like John Jeffries and others, we just don't have people of that calibre now. That's a reality.
Dave Armstrong, thanks for chairing the debate.
I've enjoyed every minute of it. I'll go quietly off and die now.
Yeah. What are you doing now?
Happy eternity.
Are you going to a nice cafe in Cuba Street?
You know what I'm doing?
What are you doing?
I'm about to teach 12 young people a writing course, and they're the most vibrant, interesting people that you could meet all between the years of about 19 and 22, and they love Wellington, and they don't think it's dying, but they admit there's problems.
Don't bother going to Astoria because it's shut.
Well, that's definite evidence of death for the city.
Were you both disappointed about Astoria as an aside?
Yes, very much so, and it shows the danger of what happens when you sell and the brand is lost. When Sue and Janice and Michael Hirschfeld opened Astoria, it was the classiest place to meet, us, Carol Hirschfeld. And what is such a tragedy is that it was sold and the brand was ruined. And that's I just think it's so sad. They want to set up an Italian restaurant or something. There are enough Italian restaurants in Wellington.
I can agree with Chris on that one. However, there are so many other exciting, vibrant cafes that we can go to that it doesn't really matter.
There's a great... That's
like
true.
What?
Well, I'm trying to think. There are a couple of new ones that I discovered in Cooper Street, and off the side, those little laneways. I was amazed.
Squirrel's one of my favourites.
Squirrel.
Yeah, so, love Squirrel.
Point being, Chris, is that sometimes the old cafe's got to make way for the new, yeah? Anyway.
Chris does seem to be a little stuck in the past here.
No, Astoria was only 25 years old before it went down the gurgler. And it needn't have gone down the gurgler.
But it did.
Kirk's gone.
Yes.
The old regime is dying.
I'll tell you another one that's gone. It's a great tragedy. Is Matterhorn was great for a Sunday roast. Yes.
We're not living in the past, Chris.
Midnight Espresso. We're
looking forward to the future now.
Midnight Espresso is going too, apparently. 13 away from 5. Your memories, why do you love Wellington? You can text us 2101 to this. We're all continuing to find solutions to housing. Anecdotal evidence suggests that if you didn't own a home by the age of 40 today... You never would. Housing and public policy researcher Dr. K. Savile Smith said recently. So an item on whether by Kelly Dennett on whether prefab housing could be the future of housing caught our attention. Some estimates suggest factory line prefab home assembly can shave 15% off costs. However, what needs to happen to make prefab dwellings more feasible, if indeed it is a solution? With us is Mark Graham, building commentator from The Building Guide. Mark, kia ora.
Kia ora, how are we doing?
Very well. And I know we've discussed this a couple of years back, but we're really looking at all options now, aren't we? Is prefab an option, or as they call it, the off-site sector?
Well, it's certainly an option, and it's certainly part of the solution. But as with anything complex, it's not going to have a simple answer.
Yeah.
And modular housing isn't the simple magic bullet that we're looking for.
Yes, and that's and it's fair to point out in the short time we have, there's a few complexities in this, isn't there? But one being, you've got to have the land, don't you? And land scarce too.
Well, there's plenty of land in New Zealand, you know, but... What we're trying to do is change how we build so that we don't keep sprawling out into endless suburbs of G.J. Gardner brick and tile homes and require people to travel their cars to their work for kilometres on end and pollute the air and build infrastructure that costs 10 times as much as if we build something for an apartment building. So we have to change how we live, we have to change how we build and how we get around. So... prefab housing or prefab buildings can certainly be used for apartment buildings as well.
Right.
But it's not the only solution. And, you know, we've also got to change what our expectations are. A lot of New Zealanders have a desire for a bespoke home as opposed to buying something that 20,000 other people have.
Okay, here's a practical example. Talking to a person recently, a young person in her 30s. There's no way Chris Finlayson of ever getting a home because they're too priced out. The small savings of about $60,000. The only way, perhaps, is building one of these prefabricated homes on the back of her parents' section. Chris?
Oh, I think the contribution that was made by... your colleague who's just spoken was absolutely excellent, because I think we need to start to think about different kinds of cities, and a tack on of mum and dad's house is certainly not what I would consider to be appropriate. But we need to look at greater intensification, look at cities like sort of Vienna and so on, ones that are really beautiful, but the idea that we could continue to spread out into some of that beautiful horticultural land in Pukekohe and so on. I'm afraid those days are gone.
Mark?
Can I? Yeah, if I could just interrupt here, there's a couple of things there. So appreciate the support there, but the first thing is actually, you know, building a smaller dwelling or another dwelling on the back of somebody's section is actually intensification. So that's actually a good thing, and especially when somebody is doing that with the support of their parents, you know, it's a multi-generational wealth and down kind of thing. But you know, an interesting thing about Vienna is they're lauded for their social housing. And yet what they did was they went through in the, I think it was the 50s, and wholesale demolished whole swathes of heritage areas and built these beautiful social housing apartments. So they didn't have the kind of concerns that we had around housing, heritage areas, for instance. Their concern was about building more houses for their people. So there's an interesting twist for the whole thing.
All right, Sue.
Yeah, well, I mean, I find myself in agreement with all of the above. And yes, we do have to completely redesign our cities. And yes, it is tragic that young people find themselves, you know, locked out of the market. And so, yes, I guess we are going to have to look at these so-called, some of these prefabricated housing. I see someone said they built a prefabricated house in 16 weeks instead of years, and it saved them 15% off construction. So anything that makes housing a bit more accessible and affordable, we've got to look
at. Well, you know, it's interesting that you say affordable, because if you go and have a look at some of those modular home websites, their homes aren't that more affordable.
Okay.
There's one that I looked at that had 150 square meter house, and it was $450,000. Worked out at $2,800 a square meter. Now, you know, G.J. Gardner builds homes for that much. So there's not really always a cost saving. You can often get a better build because they're building it within a factory. They don't have to worry about things like weather. They can certainly turn them around faster. And if we build a lot of them, but if we really want to make them affordable, then we need to build dense housing, you know, but we need to build a lot of them at scale. And, you know, we've had modular housing companies go bust because they can't get the customers. And it's still an uphill battle. You know, banks don't always support them. The council consent systems don't always support them. Mm. And there's a general ignorance about how to make those things work as well.
I used to own the smallest house in Wellington, 17 Selwyn Terrace in Thorndon, and the point you make is a very good one, because I bought it in late 80s or something for $130,000, and it sold a few months ago for about $850,000. So, and it's
how big was it?
It's on the smallest site. Go to it, 17 Selwyn Terrace, tiny little house, and very
classy.
Well, you
know, my first house, which I bought with my wife in 2000 in Westmere, cost me $270,000, and it was an ex-state duplex, 60 square metres with a big backyard.
Wow.
All right, and we lived in that for 4 years before we built out the back. You know, there's a degree of buying what you can afford, and the median house price in Auckland's about $1 million, but that doesn't mean all houses are $1 million. And you can buy something for $500,000 or $600,000 if you're prepared to go out to Glen
Where?
Or,
you know, back
Where?
In, back in the
Rangui,
day. Back in the
Those
day,
houses.
The city, like in Wellington, back to Wellington, in the 60s, I think, the city council was involved in massive building of social housing all over Wellington, which still exists.
Well,
and I haven't quite worked out why councils
John Banks
aren't doing that again.
The Auckland Housing, Auckland Council Housing to
Sold
Housing
it.
NZ.
Mm.
May I ask Sue a question?
Yes.
Sue, why is it that Wilson block on the terrace is not demolished yet? Because your Green colleagues seem to be taking an absolutist approach to its being demolished. They say it has great heritage value, but it's a dump.
You're trying to sort of point blame here, they happen to be Heritage New Zealand, which has people, experts upon it, who have decided that it is a piece of heritage. So Probably your government appointed the members, the experts on Heritage New Zealand. Of course, so no cheap shots.
Isn't one of the great examples of brutalist architecture in the country? Might look a little sore
now. It's not one of my favourites. But
it's been empty for 10 years.
It has.
And it's rotting.
Well, so ask Heritage New Zealand.
Yes, maybe it's a question not for Sue, but for Heritage
Mark,
New Zealand.
Mark, do you know this building?
Didn't David Cormack have a solution for that?
Oh, yes, he did not like it at all. Oh, we found out the square meter. It's your old house, Chris. It's amazing who texts in. Your old house is 70 square meters.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
The size of many retirement units.
Yeah, I had a kitchen I never used.
Okay, why was that? Why wouldn't you have cooked?
I used to go out.
Mark, on that note, we'll say goodbye. Mark Graham, thank you very much for that.
Pleasure as always.
Just on a final note, Chris Finlayson and Sue Kirchin with me today, and we've only got a minute or so, is cancel culture a winner as a political issue? According to Thomas Coughlin's reporting, there was a meeting of around 60 National Party members. Pollster David Farrar speaking, apparently saying he saw the party winning support by taking a stand on cancel culture issues. So I thought we've got two former MPs here. I wanted to get your sense of whether you thought that would fly as a campaign or an issue. Chris?
Well, it was interesting. You never asked me about John Lennon, which I was a bit offended by, but certainly in the mid-60s it seems that he was the subject of cancel culture. So it probably has been around for some time. Yeah. I can't for the life of me understand why they want to cancel Dr. Seuss or my beloved Fawlty Towers. So we live in crazy times, but are they any crazier than the 60s?
Sue?
Sadly, I would suspect that the National Party would do quite well if they zoomed in on all this wokester and cancel culture, because the right loves to foment these so-called culture wars, you know, and accusing everyone of being woke.
And do they, Chris?
No, I think it's...
Former leader, Simon Bridges, wanted to...
It wasn't mine, but I don't want to be disagreeable with Sue, but it happens on the left as well. It's an endemic at the moment.
But I think it is... cancel culture is unfortunate because it's the polarising intolerance instead of we should all be trying to be a little bit kinder and more tolerant.
On that wonderful note, you've both been fantastic. Chris Finlayson and Sue Kirchley, thank you very much for being on the show today.
Thank you, Wallace. Goodbye.
Thank you,
See you later. I'm Wallace. Back tomorrow, 3:45. Bye.